Well, this is Bob. This is Bob. Alice is downstairs. You're in the Bob room. It's a fantastic facility. Okay, we have two excellent presenters here who are going to teach you some wonderful things. We're going to start with Dr. Richard F. here. I gave you a bit of a background to him yesterday, and he's going to introduce the idea of holographic universe. So fasten your seatbelts and pay close attention.
Okay, so welcome to Perimeter Institute's Black Hole Science Cafe. So the idea of these sessions is to introduce you to some of the wonders and mysteries of our amazing universe and to invite you to share in the huge excitement of current research and discovery at the frontiers of knowledge. Okay, so Black Hole Science Cafe. The title of our session today is A Question, The World as a Hologram? But let me just begin by saying that the universe is deeply mysterious. And this question right here is closely tied to one of the deepest mysteries ever uncovered. It's a really, really cool question. So the next little while, what I'm going to do is bring you up to speed on what this question means, why it's so incredibly fascinating. And so basically, I'm going to tell you something about the universe that's just going to totally blow your mind. Okay? And then I'm going to turn it over to you and to try to make sense of, to put together the pieces, to try to make sense of what all this might mean. Okay? And trying to make sense of that means asking questions. Okay, that's how science works, right? We ask questions. Okay, so to help us with your questions, we have with us a special guest today, Dr. Robert McNeese. He's a researcher here at Perimeter Institute, and he has given a great deal of thought to this question, and so he'll help us out. And my name is Richard Epp, as you know, and so let's begin. Right, so the first question that I want to ask is this question. What do we know about the universe? That's a pretty big question. Okay, we know a lot. Right? Okay, now if we were to sort of summarize that in just two words, what would those two words be? What do you think? Big. Yes, the universe is big. We know that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Ever expanding.
Ever expanding. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so there are lots of things like that we know about the universe. Let me just throw two words at you. If we were to summarize sort of our physics knowledge of how things work, the two words would be quantum and relativity. These two ideas are the foundations upon which basically all of 20th century physics is based and upon which 21st century physics is still moving. Okay, so our universe is quantum in nature. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about what that means a little bit later. For now, I just want to say that the quantum nature of our universe was discovered by people trying to address a very, very deep mystery. And that mystery is, how is it possible for atoms to exist in our universe? Okay, the quantum nature of the universe allowed us to understand this. Okay, so this is an animation of a typical atom. A modern understanding of an atom showing orbitals, you know, s and p and all that stuff. How many of you have seen this kind of a model of the atom in chemistry, electron orbitals and all that? Okay, excellent. So you're all experts on this. Okay, so let's turn to relativity. So our universe is relativistic in nature. So what does that mean? Well, we'll talk a little bit about that more later. All I want to say for now is that the relativistic nature of the universe was discovered by Albert Einstein, right? When he was trying to understand the deeper nature of space, time, and gravity. So to sum it up, relativity gave us an understanding of how gravity works. Okay, so this is a really cool animation of gravity, a modern understanding of gravity in action. So this is a neutron star which is orbiting a black hole, and it's experiencing very, very strong tidal forces, which is ripping the neutron star apart. Okay, so all the little bits of the neutron star are spiraling in like water going down a drain into this black hole. And as they spiral in, the bits of matter rub against each other, heat up white hot, and there's this blinding flash of X-rays that comes off. Okay, so our universe is a really cool, super dynamical place. A place that we wouldn't have understood this without a relativistic understanding of how gravity works. Okay, so that's all very fine and well. We've got quantum and relativity. This is the foundations upon which all of 20th century physics is based. Okay, so that's great.
The problem, and of course there's always a problem, the problem is that the quantum and relativistic natures of the universe don't work together. They're different languages, they just don't get along. Okay, so on the side of quantum is all about probability. Okay, so the world of atoms and subatomic particles, in that world, we can't predict for certain what is going to happen in any given situation. Okay, all we can do is give the odds. The probability this will happen, the probability that will happen. Okay, it's all about chance. It's a world of chance and probabilities. Okay? With relativity, on the other hand, relativity is all about geometry. Okay? And so in the world of space, time, and gravity, everything is completely predictable. Okay, and obeys laws that are very, very precise geometrical laws, were discovered by Einstein. So planets orbit the sun according to very predictable and precise geometrical laws. Okay, so what we've got here is two sides of a coin. We've got two very, very different natures of the universe. So it's almost as if the universe has sort of a split personality, okay, like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Okay, so on the one hand, we've got quantum, which is all about probability and chance. On the other hand, we've got relativity, which is all about geometry and making, you know, and predictability and all that. Okay, so two totally different natures or personalities. Or another way to look at it is the universe is sort of like apples and oranges. Okay, they just don't mix. Okay, and so this leads to, well, a very, very deep question about the nature of our universe. A question that physicists have spent a great deal of time, probably at least 70 years now, 80 years now, grappling with. A very deep question. And that question is, how is it possible for our universe to even exist? Okay? Because on the one hand, we've got these quantum, the universe behaves according to quantum, chance and probability. On the other hand, the universe behaves according to relativity, exact geometry and all that stuff. How these coexist in the universe, we don't know. I mean, clearly they do, because we're in this universe, it exists. We do some experiments, we see quantum behavior. We do some experiments, we see relativistic behavior. But we don't understand how these two can actually coexist. They do, but we don't understand how. So what physicists have been looking for a long time now, is a deeper understanding of the universe. One that is deeper than quantum or relativity, and one which from which we would see quantum and relativity as just two sides of the same coin. So bringing those two different personalities together into one whole person, or one apple orange, as it were. Okay, so this is called the theory of quantum gravity. And we're not quite there yet. Okay? So this brings us to the point where you guys get involved. Okay? So here we go. Your mission. Okay, so your mission is twofold, two things. First thing is you are going to learn quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. Sound doable?
Yeah.
How many say doable?
No.
All right, okay. And then using that new, deep, profound knowledge of how the universe works, you are going to use your imagination and creativity, and you're going to guess what are these two things, quantum and relativity, trying to tell us about the deeper nature of the universe. Okay? Does that sound doable?
No.
I've been working on this for 70 years. Okay, so, right, so guess what they're trying to tell us about the universe. All right, okay. So, let's move on then to step one. Quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. So, are you ready? Here we go. Okay, so, first with quantum. So, the first and simplest things, the thing that you learn about quantum theory, can be expressed in a really simple formula. E equals hf, which says that light is made of particles. Those particles are called photons. And those photons have energy, E, which is related to their frequency, their color. So a blue photon, for example, has more energy than a red photon. Okay, how many of you have seen this thing, sort of thing before? Okay, so most of you. Okay, excellent. Okay, so here's
left.
Sorry?
30 seconds
left. All right, here we go. Okay, so this is a really cool animation. The yellow particles are electrons. The blue particles are positively charged atoms. Okay, and so as these electrons pass near an atom, their path gets deflected. And when it gets deflected, there's some chance that they will make a particle of light. Okay, so the particles of light which are being created in this picture are the little fiery particles which zip around, little bundles of energy which zip around at the speed of light. And so we're witnessing the creation of light itself. Light is a very quantum process. Okay? Right, so that's quantum. Okay, light is photons, photons have energy. Okay, so let's move on to relativity. Okay, so relativity, one of the first and simplest things we learn about relativity can also be expressed in a very simple equation. E equals mc squared. How many of you have not seen that equation? Excellent. All right. Okay, so that equation says that energy and mass are interchangeable. So energy can be converted into mass, and vice versa. Mass can be converted back into energy. Energy like in the form of photons, or particles of light. Okay, so this is a really cool animation here, which shows a particle of matter, which has mass, and a particle of antimatter, which has mass. They come together, the mass disappears, and what appears are those two yellow particles, which are photons, pure energy. So matter, in the form of this, matter and antimatter, that has mass, has disappeared, and what has appeared in its place is pure radiant energy in the form of photons. So matter, mass has been converted to energy. And the reverse can also be done. Okay, so that's a very important thing. Okay, so that's it. Quantum and relativity maybe a little more than 60 seconds. Okay, so light is photons, they have energy, and energy and mass are interchangeable. Okay, so now we should be able to understand the nature of quantum gravity, right? Anyone have any ideas so far? No? Okay. Actually, there's one more thing which is going to help you. One more thing about the universe that we must understand. Okay, so this is something which is actually sort of obvious, but you might not have thought about it before. Okay, so, and that is that information is physical. Okay, so information is not abstract. Whenever information occurs, it occurs in some concrete physical form. Okay, information must be represented in some concrete physical form or another. I'll give you lots of examples of this, okay, to get the idea across. So there's Einstein. Einstein's head was full of ideas. Okay, those ideas are a form of information. Okay, so, and that information can be, say, written down on a piece of paper, can be expressed, say, for example, in this form. So this is an idea in Einstein's head appearing on a piece of paper. So this is a page from Einstein's notebook where he is describing how gravity bends light. Okay, so the information in that idea is encoded, is embodied in some physical form. Okay, namely, the way the molecules of ink are arranged on that piece of paper. Okay, so there is a physical embodiment of information. Okay, so now some of you might object and say, well, what about the idea, the thought in his head itself? What physical form does that information take? Okay, so, well, here's a picture of someone's head, say Einstein's head, the brain. Okay, so clearly those ideas are in Einstein's brain. Well, how is that information represented physically? What physical form does it take? Well, of course, the brain, as you know, is composed of billions of neurons, and those neurons can interconnect in zillions and zillions of different ways. So information is encoded partly in the complex interconnections of this huge neural network. Okay, and then the electrical impulses excite that network, and we, or Einstein, have thoughts. Okay? Of course, we don't understand the details of that. That's one of the great mysteries still in science, trying to understand the nature of how that all works. But basically, the idea is there. Okay? So even thoughts and ideas take a physical form inside our brain. Okay? So information is physical. Okay, let me give you another example. Okay? So let's say, how is information stored in a computer, for example, like a USB memory stick and so on? Okay, well, first of all information, when it comes to computers, all information takes the form of long strings of numbers, zeros and ones. How many of you are sort of vaguely aware of that? Okay, actually, all of you, oh, fantastic. Okay, so information in a computer takes the form of zeros and ones. How is that information physically manifest, physically represented in the computer? Well, for example, 0 and 1 might be represented in a capacitor. Say a high voltage on the capacitor represents a 1, a low voltage represents a 0. Or a physical current, flow of electrons through a transistor. Okay? When there's flow of electrons, that's a 1. When there's no flow, that's a 0. Okay? So a physical information, zeros and 1s, take a physical form. And when a computer processes information, same thing. It processes it by doing physical things. It, for example, directs the flow of those electrons this way and that way. Okay? So again, information is physical. It must be manifest in some physical form. It's not just this abstract thing. Okay, one last example here is you're surfing the web. Okay, so you're downloading something from the internet. What is happening really? What is physically happening in the real physical world? Okay, well, here you are connected to the internet. This is actually a real representation of the internet. Okay, and so what is that? It's this massive web of wired, wireless, and fiber optic links, which spans the whole globe, connecting nodes like this. And zillions of nodes are interconnected with these links. And so information, in the form of long strings of zeros and ones, passes from node to node. Okay, but how? Physically, what is happening? Well, a good example is, or one example of how that happens is information is coded in photons. So for example, when there's a bunch of photons, that represents a one. When there's no photons, that represents a zero. So you send these bunches or no bunches of photons down a real glass fiber optic cable. There's real physical stuff, energy in that cable moving down. Okay, so information is physically moved around. Yeah.
So what about the wireless?
And wireless, the same thing. So wireless, that means radio waves. Oh. And radio waves, radio is an example of a part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And all light, whether it's visible light or radio waves or microwaves, they're all photons. Okay, so there, it's the same deal. It's also photons. Okay, so there we go. So I hope you're all convinced now information is physical and have a feeling for what that means. Okay, so now we've put the pieces together. We know a bit about relativity. We know a bit about quantum. And we also know that in our universe, information is physical. So now what we're going to do is put that together. Okay, so let me just actually just sort of summarize so far. So quantum tells us that photons have energy. Okay, so any source of light, what we have is particles coming out, and those particles are little bundles of energy. Okay. Relativity tells us that energy is equivalent to mass, certainly as far as gravity is concerned, and that will play an important role shortly. And the third thing we know, just generally, is that information is not abstract. It must be represented, must be embodied in one physical form or another. And a good example is embodying information as it flows through the internet, embodying it in physical photons. All right? Okay. So having all those pieces together, let's now move on to step two, which is asking the question, what are quantum and relativity trying, just dying to tell us about the deeper nature of how the universe is? Okay? This is a hard question. I know I appreciate that. Okay, so to help focus our attention, we're gonna focus our attention on this sphere, or say this sphere, the space within this sphere. Okay, and the idea is, or the question that we want to focus our attention on is this. This is the central question here. Okay, how much information can we cram into this sphere? Knowing that, one, information is physical, okay, information must be represented in some physical form or another, and so anything physical has energy, and energy is equivalent to mass, and all that kind of stuff, okay? So that's the question we want to address. Right, so let's begin. How much information, what's the maximum information we can put into this sphere? So first of all, as you indicated, you're all basically convinced that information of any kind can be boiled down to a long string of numbers. And let's just use the numbers 0 and 1, which is the way computers store and process information, and it's the way information travels through the internet and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so basically what we want to get is information in the form of a long string of zeros and ones into the space inside this sphere. Okay, so information is not an abstract thing. Information is a physical thing. We need to find some physical way to encode that information. Okay, so does anyone have an idea of how we might do that? What might we use? How might we encode that information and send it into that sphere? What about using the way it's done on the internet, using photons? Let's encode that information in photons. Okay, now, it turns out that photons are a particularly convenient physical form in which to encode information, because when a photon is zipping at the speed of light, that photon, that bundle of energy, can be spinning either clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay, so that's great. So we can encode whenever we see a 1 here, we use a clockwise photon. Whenever we see a 0, we use a counterclockwise photon. So we encode this string of zeros and ones in a sequence of photons, which we fire into that sphere. Okay, and maybe the inside of the sphere is coated with like a mirror coating, and the photons bounce around and so on and so forth. We don't need to worry about the details of that. Basically, we're putting information into that sphere. All right, are we okay? All right, excellent. Okay, so basically one photon is then representing one bit of information. Okay, so and we're firing those into the sphere. Now, quantum tells us something. So now here's where our understanding of quantum and relativity comes in. Quantum tells us that every time we have a photon, we also have energy. Photons have energy. So every time we put a single bit of information, a 0 or 1, into that sphere, we're also putting energy into that sphere. Okay, so that's very important. Quantum tells us the information is associated with energy. So what that means is the more information we try to jam into that sphere, the more energy we're jamming into that sphere. Okay? Okay, so the next step is what we learned about relativity. Relativity tells us that energy and mass are equivalent as far as, say, for example, gravity is concerned. So what I mean by that is we've got a sphere full of energy, okay, in the form of photons. That energy will gravitate, okay, will cause a gravitational attraction to this thing, will attract this thing, in exactly the same way as a sphere full of matter would attract this thing. Okay, they're equivalent in that sense. Okay, so what that means is that that putting more information into that sphere is effectively the same as putting more mass into the sphere. Okay? So at the end of the day, our question, our original question, what is the maximum information we can jam into that sphere, boils down to the question, what is the maximum mass we could jam into a region of space, say, this size? Okay? So here's a question. Does anyone have any sense of what, might there be some kind of process, or might there be something which limits the amount of mass I could jam into this region of space? I mean, I start jamming in more and more and more mass into this region of space. What's eventually going to happen?
It'll become a black hole eventually, exactly. Okay, so that's the limit. So the limit is the black hole limit. And a black hole, as some of you may know, a black hole is a region of space from where gravity is so strong that basically nothing can emerge from it. Yeah?
But wouldn't that mean then it'd be an infinite amount? Because after it becomes a black hole, then it would just keep having more mass and more mass?
Well, okay, so we've put a finite amount of information in here, finite amount of mass has formed this black hole, but we could continue to add more. The thing about it, though, if we add more information, we're adding more mass, and the black hole will grow in size.
Oh, okay.
So we're saying for a region of a fixed size, how much information can we cram in? We hit the black hole limit. If we try to put more in, it'll grow bigger. Okay? So the black hole really represents the limit of how much information we can jam in there. Okay, so if we did it like here, you know, outside or something, you might do something like that. We would do that to the world. Okay, well, Right, so here's a simple formula which relates the size of the region, so R here is the radius of our sphere, to the mass that's required, how much mass we have to jam in there to form a black hole. Okay, C here is the speed of light, and G is what? So Newton's constant of gravity. Right, okay. So there we go. So let me just sort of summarize the argument here, because this is it. Okay, so this the argument is very, very simple. Okay, so the idea is basically we want to put information in this region of space, jam it full as much as possible. We know that information is physical. Anything that is physical has energy, and energy is equivalent to mass. The more information we cram in effectively means the more mass we're cramming in. Eventually, the limit is a black hole forms. A black hole is another part of our relativistic understanding of the universe. Okay, does everyone understand that argument? Does that make sense? Okay, so that's very important. So now here's your homework, actually, you won't say. It turns out that if you take the three simple equations, E equals HF from quantum, E equals MC squared from relativity, and this equation over here, and you combine them together, you've got to be a little bit clever about this, but if you combine them together, if you find a way to do that, it's actually quite simple. You will discover something totally astounding. Okay? And that's what we're coming to right now. I'll just write down the result. Okay? It's very, very simple algebra. The result is that A black hole will form if you cram a certain amount of information in that sphere. Okay? And that amount of information is proportional to the area, the surface area of that sphere. Okay? And it's the surface area of that sphere measured in certain units. Okay? So it's the surface area of the sphere measured in these units. That funny A there is called the Planck area. Okay? So it's area measured in units of Planck area. Planck area is a very, very super tiny little patch of area, 10 to the minus 66 square meters. Let me actually just talk about that for a little bit. Suppose that we were trying to measure the surface area of the Earth. Okay, what unit of area would we use? What would be convenient? Something like, for example, a square meter. A square meter is about the size of a human. I can relate to that. I understand what a square meter is. So if you tell me the Earth is so and so many square meters in size, I will say, oh yeah, I have a sense of what that means. Okay? It turns out that the square meter is not a natural, it's natural for humans to use, but it's not natural for nature herself. Nature herself, which is governed by quantum and relativity, turns out there's a natural size in which, or size of surface area in which nature thinks. And that's this Planck area. Okay, so when nature asks, how big is something? Nature asks how many Planck units of area would fit around that thing, not how many square meters would fit around that thing. So it's just a natural unit of area that occurs in our universe. Okay, so that's that. Now this result here, that the maximum information we can jam to the sphere is being proportional to the area, is extremely bizarre. And I want to focus on two ways in which this result is very bizarre. Okay, so the first way is that, first of all, it tells us that the amount of information is finite, as opposed to infinite. Now, if you didn't realize, or if you hadn't really thought of the idea that somehow information is physical, if you were thinking information is abstract, well, I can put any amount of information in here. It's just this abstract idea. But when you realize that information is physical, okay, it's manifested in one physical form or another, and then anything physical has energy, and the energy is equivalent to mass, so you can cram enough in a black hole form, it becomes all physical, and you realize that really in our universe there's a limit. Okay? It's finite, the amount of information you can cram in here. Is it a big number? Is it a lot? Let's look at this sphere. This sphere has a surface area of about 1 square meter. If we take 1 square meter, divide by, forget what the factor 4 there, divide by this Planck area, 1 divided by 10 to the minus 66 is? 10 to the plus 66. It's saying that, so this result is telling us that we could fit about 10 to the 66 bits of information into this region of space before a black hole forms. Is that a lot, 10 to the 66, what do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot. So I just did a calculation the other day, just playing around, and I thought, okay, using current technology of hard drives and USB and all that stuff, how much information could be crammed in here? Well, it's about 10 to the 20 bits. 10 to the 20 is much, much smaller than 10 to the 66. It's 46 orders of magnitude smaller. 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 is 46 times. Okay? So our current technology is like super, super primitive. We are nowhere near what appears to be allowed by nature. Okay, so we have a lot of like progress to make in the area of information storage density on hard drives and all that kind of stuff. Anyways, okay, so the second thing is that what's really bizarre about this result, and this is actually more bizarre, is that it depends upon not the volume of the region of space, but its surface area. Okay, I want to make this point. This is very important because it's extremely, extremely bizarre. So let me just go to the blackboard here. So here is our region of space, this sphere here, and it's of radius r. What is the volume of a sphere of radius r? Math. What is the surface area? What's the surface area of a sphere of radius r?
4 pi r squared.
Okay, so if I take this sphere and if I double the radius, what happens to the volume? By what factors does the volume increase? Double the radius.
Cubic.
Cube. So we cube the 2. 2 times 2 times 2 is 8. So it goes to 8 times the volume. What if I do the same thing, increase the sphere radius by a factor of 2, by how much does the surface area increase? 4. 2 times 2 is 4. Increases by a factor of 4. So what we learn is that if we have some region of space, when we increase it in size, we learn that the volume, the space inside, increases a lot more quickly than the surface area. Okay, so if we're jamming information into that volume, we would expect the maximum amount of information to grow like the volume grows, like pretty fast. But what we find instead, this thing is telling us that no, it's growing only as fast as surface. Okay, so there's much less information that we can jam in than we might have thought. Okay, so that's very, very important, and I want to elaborate on that a little bit more. Okay, so this connection here between information, or this possible connection between information and area, has led some physicists to speculate that maybe this sort of thing is maybe one of the deepest hints we have at the nature of quantum gravity, the nature of reality. Okay, so let me just recap here. Here's our sphere. We've discovered through very, very simple reasoning that the maximum information we can jam in there is proportional to the area measured in Planck units. Okay, so the Planck unit of area is indicated by the little red triangle there. For every 4 Planck units of area, so the factor of 4 here, we can fit one bit of information, either a 0 or a 1, into that sphere. Okay? So when we think about filling that sphere with information, in our minds, at least in my mind, the idea is we're filling the volume. We're putting zeros and ones in the form of transistors or atoms or electrons or whatever. We're putting those zeros and ones in the volume, inside that volume. That's how I would be thinking about it. But nature is apparently thinking very differently, at least in terms of the maximum amount of information. In terms of the maximum amount of information, nature's not thinking about putting the zeros and ones inside the volume. It's thinking about painting zeros and ones on the surface, inside those little clump areas. And so that a maximum information is basically how many little Planck areas there are on the surface of your sphere. Okay, so what it means is there's a lot less information than expected. So this is really, really bizarre. So just, I mean, think about this. It's we're talking not about the volume, we're talking just about the surface. That's a lot less information than you might have expected. It's the same amount of information as for a reality, quote unquote, living on just the surface of the sphere. Okay, without any regard for what's inside, the third dimension, moving radial inward, the volume inside. That's an extremely bizarre result. Okay, so this leads us to the title of our session here, which is The World is a Hologram. Okay, so a lot of you are familiar with holograms. You've seen these things. Actually, most of what are called holograms out there are not true holograms. A true hologram, it looks like this. It's a two-dimensional picture like this, which doesn't look like much. It looks like little wavy lines, little splotches. It's an interference pattern, it's called. Okay, so it doesn't look like much until you shine a laser light on it, illuminate it with laser light, and then something almost magical happens. You realize that two-dimensional surface actually contains three-dimensional information. Okay, in the sense that if you were to, here's my little hologram, I've illuminated with a laser light. If I view it from this side, say the left-hand side, I will see maybe a guy's, the right-hand side of a guy's face. Okay, if I move over to the other side, okay, like this, then I will see the left-hand side of the guy's face. So as I move around, I see three-dimensional information. It's as if there's a three-dimensional person living inside that surface. Okay, there's three-dimensional information contained in that two-dimensional surface. Okay, that's completely analogous to what we're talking about here. With our sphere, what we're doing is we're putting basically information into this three-dimensional volume, and the information in that three-dimensional volume is somehow just equivalent, at least in the maximum case, is somehow equivalent to just painting the information on the surface as little zeros and ones, just like a hologram on the two-dimensional surface. Is that connection clear, the analogy here with a hologram? Okay, so this idea has led physicists to ask, or has led some physicists to speculate that maybe somehow, don't know how, but maybe somehow our world really is some kind of a hologram. It's holographic in nature. Okay, so to get across that idea, here's a picture of a person living in a hologram. So it's a two-dimensional person, just like our two-dimensional hologram here. Okay, but that person has sort of imagines herself as being a three-dimensional being. Okay, there's sort of this illusion of three dimensions, having height and width and depth. okay, like our three-dimensional person here. Okay? So this is like freaky. This is totally freaky. Right? We don't know. I must emphasize that we don't know if this, if our universe is really like this. But putting these simple ideas together, we come up with this result. What are we supposed to do? We're going to try to make sense of this, right? Maybe something like this is true. We don't know how yet. But now here's the point where real creativity takes off, and we try to make sense of this result. So there's, I should just mention here, there's three big names associated with this. One is Jacob Bekenstein, and one is Stephen Hawking, and one is Lenny Sisman. So these three names are associated with this idea, and of course many other people are thinking about this. But here's just a quote from Jacob Bekenstein, which I think nicely summarizes the situation. Okay, so our everyday perceptions of the world as three-dimensional, like this here, would then be either a profound illusion, okay, or merely one of two alternative ways of viewing reality. Isn't that cool? Okay, so I think I've said enough, blah, 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 blah. So now what I'd like to do is turn it over to you, and what do you think about this? Okay, so remember that we have Bob McNeese here, and he's our resident expert with the questions. So, any questions? Just give you a moment to digest all that. Yeah?
Well, do you mean that we are 3D and then, or we see it as 3D and that we actually convey like 4D information, or we see it as 3D and it's actually 2D?
That's a really good question, because one of the other things that we learned from Einstein is that we don't get very far if we think about space and time independent. To make sense of the world, we have to think of space and time as things that can be mixed up, and normally we don't notice that in our everyday activities, like when we see cars driving down the street, we don't notice all these relativistic effects that worried Einstein, but ultimately you have to worry about them. And this is the kind of extreme situation where things are very massive or fast, where you have to worry about these relativistic considerations. So, yeah, we live in, say, a four-dimensional space-time, and when we have an argument like this, we're talking about how much information we can, you know, cram into, say, a three-dimensional volume of space. Like he was saying, literally, inside, you know, a ball of this size. And the limit ends up having to do with the two-dimensional area of this three-dimensional volume. So when you talk about the actual physics that's going on, yeah, you've got a four-dimensional space-time, and so something happens now, and then something happens a little bit later, and that's the time part. But when we talk about the limits on information, we're talking about literally how much info you can cram in this three-dimensional volume inside this ball.
If we go back to Bekenstein's quote here, I mean, it's sort of like, just to add to what Bob is saying, it's sort of like, okay, so let's look at this. So every perception of the world is 3D with either a profound illusion. So it would be an illusion in the sense that, suppose it were really true that we were living, in some sense, on surfaces of regions. That somehow, in some weird sense, we don't understand, it's all about surfaces. Like just say at one instant of time, forget about the four-dimensional universe, at one instant of time we have a three-dimensional space. And maybe it's not about things moving around in that space. Maybe it's really about some weird surfaces somehow and things living in those surfaces. Okay? If that were the case, then our three-dimensional existence, which is certainly I feel like three-dimensional, right? I don't know about you, but I certainly feel three dimensions, right? And I can go like this, I can go like this, and that might be illusion. Yeah, that's the weird thing, okay? Or simply two alternative ways of viewing reality. So the reality is we put a bunch of stuff inside that sphere, or this room. There's a bunch of stuff going on in this room. Okay, ultimately, it's just atoms and subatomic particles moving around and so on. And we can describe that in two different ways. That's the idea. One way is we could describe this particle is at this position in three-dimensional space and it's zipping around like when you walk there, that particle moves there, and so on. We could describe the motion of things in three-dimensional space. Or equivalently, we could find some clever way of describing what's happening in the room just by looking at what's happening on the surface, representing what's happening in some weird theory just on the surface of the room. In other words, basically what it's saying is that what's happening in this three-dimensional room, all the particles zipping around and so on and so forth,
there's much less information in that than we expected. It's the same amount of information as some reality just living on the surface. Now, is that reality real, or is it just some just alternative way, mathematically alternative way of representing the three-dimensional world? Okay, that's the mystery. That's what we don't know, that's what people think about. Yeah.
Can I take a stab at this as well?
Yeah, sure. So Sean Grimm is also a resident expert here on this whole holographic idea.
Yeah, in my past life, I guess I worked on this. But I think to answer your question was, is it 3D going down to 2D or 4D going down to 3D? I think the thing that makes all this work is gravity, right? If you don't have gravity is the thing that's making black holes. Gravity is the thing that is driving the holographic principle. So what it really says is that if you have a theory of gravity in three dimensions plus time, then you can describe that by a theory that doesn't have gravity in the lower amount of dimensions. So because we have gravity, the answer to your question is really it's from 3D space to 2D space, but there's still time going.
This is just one example of how this holographic idea would work. There are lots of other examples where you have to be a little bit more careful about what you mean by time and space. Like I was saying before, Einstein said in a lot of situations, you have to mix these things up or else things won't make sense. And there are lots of examples where these holographic ideas, you know, force you to mix up time and space. And then it works a little differently than was described here. So next question, yeah?
So if you flatten that ball, would you be able to store the same amount of information?
If you flatten the ball, you'd be able to store the same amount of information. Well, so the reason for using the ball, I mean, the example here is that this ball is a good way of separating a volume of space, the volume inside, and then talking about the area that encloses that volume. So in that sense, you know, if you flatten the ball, we're no longer talking about, you mean like just cut it in the middle, fold it out like you would fold a globe out onto a map? Well, in that sense, we're no longer talking about a volume, but in the sense that it still has the same area, mm-hmm. you would say the limit on how much info you can cram in this volume is the same that you could, you know, fit into however many flank areas you need to cover that surface area when you flatten it.
Or if you let the air out, that would be the same area.
Or if you let the air out, yeah.
It's a good question, actually, because for two reasons. Because the first thing is it tells you that, suppose you flatten it a lot, but not completely flat, right? And then you stretch it out, it sort of points to the weirdness of the whole thing, right? Is that it doesn't matter what the volume of the thing is inside. You can still always describe everything that happens just by what's happening on the surface. So if you take the ball and flatten it, you can still describe the thing that's happening inside that small volume. Or if you make the ball huge, you have a huge volume inside, right? But you can still describe it by, so that's really interesting. But the other thing that is kind of important is that, I don't know if you said this, but I think that this sort of breaks down if the volume inside is smaller than one Planck volume. Mm-hmm. So if you actually flatten it down to zero, you're sort of destroying a lot of the assumptions that go into the holographic principle in the first place. So
so when we give an explanation like this and we kind of throw out some equations and say, you don't have to pay attention to all the details of the theory, it boils down to this equation, and this equation. There are a lot of assumptions going on behind the scenes. And one of those, Richard touched on earlier, he said that once you start mixing up quantum mechanics and gravity, things get kind of screwy. So something that we're implicitly doing here is we're assuming that this ball is fairly big. That is, it's not so small that quantum mechanics is really, really important, because at that point, our understanding of how quantum mechanics and gravity work together gets screwed up, and all these conclusions potentially go out the window. So we're kind of implicitly assuming that this is something, you know, big compared to, you know, quantum mechanical objects, like the size of this ball or the size of an astrophysical black hole, you know, something, you know, the mass of the sun being squeezed down or something like that. If we start talking about really, really small volumes, then things like general relativity, we start to not understand, you know, what's really going on, and a lot of these conclusions we can't say with any assurance. Question back here?
I think you might have just answered the question about it being small, but yesterday in class we talked about like super string theory and how there's got to be like 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions instead of 4 or whatever.
Yeah.
And like the supersymmetry, like there's got to be even more than that, like 26. How does the whole hologram universe plane or that?
This is a great question. Okay, so first of all, one of the things, we're going to need a little more than 60 seconds for this one. Relativity and quantum mechanics, keep doing 6, and string theory, I'm going to need at least 90. I'm a member of the string group here. This is one of the things that I worked on. And there are different varieties. So string theory, for those of you who don't know, it's more appropriate for me to call it a framework. It's a set of ideas for how you might arrive at something like a theory of quantum gravity. And in this framework, instead of particles being like little points, you allow for the fact that maybe you have little points, or maybe you also have extended objects like strings, or maybe like a membrane that kind of flaps around through however many dimensions of space-time. Now, in some varieties of string theory, you find that in order for quantum mechanics and gravity to peacefully coexist, you need something like 26 dimensions. Now, that sounds pretty outlandish, although from the point of view of the mathematics, it's maybe not as crazy as it sounds. When you incorporate something like supersymmetry so that these strings and other objects can represent the kind of particles like we see in the real world, like electrons, quarks, and things like that, then it goes down to, say, 10 dimensions for something called superstring theory. And then there are other theories that are 11-dimensional that are related. It's a really intricate mathematical structure. And at that point, it's also kind of hard to say exactly what you mean by a dimension. It becomes kind of a malleable concept. The question was, how do these holographic ideas fit in? And one of the reasons people are interested in holography is because, like Richard said at the beginning, we don't exactly know how to put quantum mechanics and gravity together. And one of the reasons is we don't really know what kind of the fundamental principle behind a theory of quantum gravity should be. With general relativity, Einstein had ideas like the equivalence principle, and you take special relativity and the equivalence principle, a couple of really simple sets of ideas, comparatively, and you put them together, this really rich structure called general relativity comes out. And you can explain a huge variety of phenomena we see in the world with only a couple, you know, kind of select fundamental principles. The same with quantum mechanics. But with quantum gravity, you know, you would think, okay, if we're going to set down some new theory, we better figure out what the fundamental ideas are. And that's where we run into a wall. We're not sure. So some people say, well, maybe this idea, this holographic principle, maybe that should be fundamental to any theory of quantum gravity. Maybe that's what we need to kind of bootstrap ourselves into understanding what's going on. So string theory, for example, kind of tries to build holography in. It kind of comes out in a natural way in string theory, which is not to say that's the only place it comes out. But when you build up a framework like string theory, something like holography is built into it. So for instance, if you try to figure out how black holes are made in string theory, you can connect these answers you get, how much information you can cram into a black hole. You can arrive at that answer a different way using what you know about strings, and you find that, you know, miraculously, what you expected from holography is what the strings end up telling you. Now, these are all kind of limited predictions. Like everything we've said today, whenever we make one of these statements, there's going to be assumptions and caveats. But you know, for lack of a better place to start looking, some people say maybe this idea should be fundamental to however we try to build quantum gravity, and then one thing that comes out of that is a theory built out of strings and other extended objects.
Just to add to what Bob said, I mean, so how do these holographic principles appear in string theory? I mean, the holographic idea is fairly general. It's more general than what we've been saying here, as Bob said. So you can just, roughly speaking, it's some kind of description of nature living in one dimension is somehow equivalent to a description of another kind of nature living in another dimension. Okay, if I were to say some nature living in, say 7 dimensions is equivalent to something different living in 6 dimensions. So it's just an equivalence between theories in different dimensions. Okay, and what's really, really cool about this, about string theory, is that string theory has actually found, or it seems to have found, a really concrete realization of this idea. Okay, so some examples of theories living in low dimensions compared to a theory living in higher dimensions, a concrete mathematical manifestation of this principle, of this holographic idea. So there's already a real concrete example in existence.
Yeah, there are examples in string theory where you know how to decode the hologram, where you know how to take that information on the surface and translate back and forth between that and the information, say, inside of this sphere. Back and forth. So something else that I want to say, maybe we can kind of illustrate why something like that happens. There was an equation down on the board earlier. We said that if you have something like a photon, the amount of energy is a constant called Planck's constant, h, times the frequency of the photon. Now, sometimes it's more convenient for us to talk about the wavelength of the photon instead of its frequency. And we know that
the wavelength times the frequency should be the speed of light. Right? Wavelength times frequency is the speed of the wave. Mm-hmm. So the energy of a photon goes like speed of light times Planck's constant divided by the wavelength. Right? So what happens when we make more energetic photons to their wavelength? Right, for the energy to get bigger, what has to happen to the wavelength? It has to get smaller, right? It's inversely proportional. So as this number gets smaller, the energy gets bigger. Now, it turns out that because of quantum mechanics, it's not just photons that do this. It's all particles. Kind of at the beginning of the century, there was a very clever, very wealthy French prince named Louis de Broglie who came up with this idea that all particles essentially should behave like waves in certain circumstances. So it turns out that if you got a particle with mass, we know that mass is equivalent to energy from E equals mc squared. Particle with some mass, it's got a wavelength too. And the more massive you make it, the more energy it's got in there, the smaller its wavelength gets. So in quantum mechanics, there's this idea that when you talk about higher and higher energies, you're talking about smaller and smaller objects. This is why we build big particle accelerators, because if we accelerate things to really high energies, we can probe smaller distances, right? If you want to kind of get in and see the details, you use a smaller and smaller probe, and that means, in this case, higher and higher energies. Now, we saw something happening in here that maybe it didn't stand out the first time, but at some point, this behavior goes screwy, because here we're saying that when something gets more and more energetic and more massive, we're talking about smaller and smaller wavelengths. But something changed when we had a black hole, because there was a formula out there that said, the amount of mass you can cram into the black hole is proportional to some constants and the radius, the size of the black hole. So now once you have a black hole, the opposite's happening. You put more stuff in, more energy, more mass, and it's getting bigger. So there was some weird turnaround in there. Something weird happened when you brought gravity into the picture. Before, you just put more energy into a particle and make it more massive, talking about smaller and smaller lengths. All of a sudden, when you have a black hole, when you try to cram too much in there, something turns around. And instead of these things getting smaller when you make them more massive, they get bigger. It's the opposite behaviors. And this is something you actually see not in the kind of theories that are built out of point particles, but in theories with extended objects like strings. If you take a string and make it more energetic, instead of getting smaller, something weird happens. It kind of fluffs out, expands, and wants to take up more space. So this kind of weird behavior you see when you make this transition from just a particle or something like that, to a system where you try to cram too much information in and you can't keep it all in there. The more you put in, the bigger it wants to get. You see this in these frameworks like string theory and some related ideas, where these extended objects make them more massive, more energetic. They get bigger instead of smaller.
Okay, so 2D looks visually different than 3D. And you're saying, well, I guess there's 10D? And like to me, 10D looks the same as 3D. So what are those other D's represent?
What are those? Okay. So a minute ago, Richard said, right, I understand 3D because I can go that way, and I don't know why I'm palming this thing. it's college basketball season started tonight. So I can go this way, and this way, right? That's how I normally think of dimensions. Now, here we're kind of skirting this line between what we think of as our everyday physical reality and the way that we mathematically understand these things. Right? And sometimes we use a concept like dimension on one side of that line, like this way, this way, this way. Other times we use a concept like dimension on the other side of the line where we're talking about the math we use to describe what's going on. So if I wanted to say where a particle is in this room, how many numbers do I have to give you?
Four,
because I want to say what time it is too, right? So I want to say, it's x position, y position, z position, and then what time. So we call that an event, right? A place and a time. So four-dimensional space-time, I got to give you four numbers. If I wanted to tell you when something happened on this table, how many numbers do I have to give you?
Three,
right? I got to give you x, y, and then when it happened. So you see the relationship there between how many dimensions we're talking about and how many numbers we use. So mathematically, I could always say, just hear me out. Let me give you five numbers. What does that mean? Well, you know, based on what we did with two dimensions plus time and three dimensions plus time, you have an idea what five numbers would mean. You're trying to tell, I'm trying to tell you some other, something, this way, this way, this way, and then
some other way to do right angles to the other three that I don't know how to do. It's kind of awesome. Break dance.
You know, mathematically, I know how to tell you that. Now, you say, well, but how does that connect to the real world? You know, well, how do I know what to make of that? I understand how to go these three ways. What good does that extra number give me? So this is a huge problem, right? When you build models and all this esoteric stuff comes out telling you, works out great, but you need another six dimensions. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that? Well, you try to figure out if there's any way that the universe can have six dimensions that you don't know about. So an example that you hear about a lot is, suppose you're standing on the other side of the yard and you got a garden hose in the yard, and from far away it basically looks like a line, right? You're like, you know what, if I want to say where something is on that object, I'm going to, you know, one number, the length along, and, you know, if we want time, when it happens. So I only need one number to say where something is on that object. But then we get closer and closer and we realize, you know what? It's not a line. It's got some more structure. It's got some circumference. So now you've got to be more careful, because if you want to tell me a specific point on that hose, you've got to tell me how far along and then, you know, kind of actually where on the surface. So you look closer and you realize that you needed to give me a little more information to be really specific. Well, when we do experiments like in particle accelerators, we're looking closer, right? From the point of view of kind of like our gross everyday reality, we only think of the phenomena we experience firing this way, and this way. But that's, you know, kind of a prejudice of our experience. And one of the things we've learned, at least in the 20th century, is that if we always come down on the side of, you know, our personal experience, we miss out on a lot of what the universe has to offer. There are a lot of things we discovered about the universe only after we tossed our personal prejudices. So one of the things that we're willing to suspend disbelief on until we're sure one way or the other is that maybe if we look closer, we're going to find that you need a little more information to say when and where something happens. Maybe if we look a little closer when two particles collide, we see that it's not quite like looking at that hose across the yard where it looks like a line. It's like getting really close to it and seeing that there's more there. But it was only apparent when we got close enough that this other distance was substantial. And in a particle accelerator, it's only going to show up when you get to high enough energies that these distances, these wavelengths, the kind of scales that these energetic particles probe, are comparable to the scales of that little extra dimension, that extra number you need to say how something's happening. So for that to be true, if there are these extra dimensions around, they have to be curled up somehow. They have to be rolled up into these very tight shapes. And that's where a lot of complication for a framework like string theory comes in, because if I've got 10 dimensions, and in my normal everyday experience, when I'm not talking about super energetic particles or black holes, I only experience three of them, then in plus time, then the other six have to be doing, so they've got to be wrapped up really tightly so that the things I'm doing just don't sense them. But it turns out that there is a huge wealth of ways you can wrap up six extra dimensions. You get these crazy mathematical shapes called Calabi-Yau manifolds. And the way that space wraps up on itself in a lot of these constructions ends up telling you things like what kind of particles you see in the universe and how they interact. So it's something that at first seems crazy, but then if you're willing to suspend disbelief and say, if it were so, if there could be these extra dimensions, what would I get out of it? Well, you get a lot of structure. You get a really rich theory. But ultimately, you know, it has to be true. You have to eventually, you know, show that this leads you to some incontrovertible fact of nature, or you have to do some experiment that senses this. When people talk about the LHC, the big collider in Switzerland, turning on, there are a lot of people who are looking very closely to see that when you collide particles together and at the end you add up all the energy that came out, is it all really there? Because some people think that some of it might leak off into these extra dimensions. And that would be kind of an indicator that there's more there than we thought there was. I think Sean has anything you want to add?
Because I wanted to say that I don't know if I really understood exactly what the question was or if it was, but like, so there's one issue of what are the extra dimensions mean. Then the other thing is, what are the extra dimensions doing in this holographic principle, right? And I think that, to be fair, in the concrete, I mean, Richard mentioned that in string theory there's a concrete realization of the holographic principle. In that realization, the extra dimensions are not really playing an important role. So as far as I know, they're sort of sitting there and doing nothing. I mean, because really what you have is you have string theory in, you know, whatever dimensions, and then the theory that you're trying to describe is or the theory on the surface is one lower dimension. So that's what it's like in string theory. And if you're trying to make contact with the real world, so that's the other thing that I want to say is that all of this is very, very abstract, right? So far, we haven't been able to do experiments with black holes and other things. But there is actually some experimental evidence of something like this existing in our world. And this is, I think, is really exciting for string theorists.
Right.
Yeah, probably. I know a lot of, it was my old supervisor, like, did a lot of things related to this. And in New York somewhere, they take gold atoms and they smash them together. And so there's all kinds of crazy stuff that happens. The particles that make up the gold nuclei split apart, and they do all kinds of crazy things. And you have this really complicated theory that until now people haven't been able to describe. But the important thing is that when you crash the gold nuclei together, the gravitational force is not very strong. So really this is a theory that doesn't have gravity. So you might think maybe there is a theory of higher dimension that you can describe, that you can use to describe what's happening with these gold nuclei using the holographic principle. So a theory of higher dimension with gravity that describes this theory of lower dimension, which is our world. And it turns out that there is such a theory. It's a form of string theory. And you can make predictions about what you'll see with these gold nuclei. And those predictions have been somewhat confirmed. I mean, there's a lot of approximations, but I think, I don't know how good the numbers are.
I would say the conservative interpretation is that when you play with these ideas like holography, when you entertain the idea that you can have a theory with gravity that can make black holes and stuff, and that ends up being, in some cases, equivalent to, like Richard was saying, something that lives on this surface, that at the very least, it gives you new insight into how kind of certain other theories might behave. So like a really conservative interpretation of what Sean just said. And some people do see this and they're like, you know, yay, evidence for string theory, we're vindicated. Other people say, well, I don't know if it's evidence or not, but maybe you've certainly uncovered a really clever way of attacking this hard problem using this kind of this out of left field approach. So
let me just add something to all of that. I'd like to emphasize that what's happening here, why is this idea so exciting? I mean, certainly there are lots of unknowns. That's what research is all about. We're trying to answer some of these questions, right? But what is so exciting about this idea? Well, if you think of a paradigm shift. Okay, so we had Newton. Newton gave us understanding of a picture of gravity, a model of gravity. Now, here's an object, there's an object. They exert some mysterious force on each other. Okay? And that was the picture of gravity that we had for a while. And then in 1915, Einstein came along and he totally changed that picture. Okay, we had an entirely new picture of what gravity is. Okay, gravity, we understand now, is a warping of space-time. That's called a paradigm shift. We go from one picture in our mind of how the universe works, mysterious force acting at a distance, one object mysteriously exerting a force on another object, to a completely different picture. No, the universe is this sort of fabric which can bend and change like a curved surface, and that's associated. That's what gravity is. Okay, so a totally different shift in our understanding, a paradigm shift. And what's, I think part of what's making this idea so exciting and compelling is that maybe this is that sort of thing. Maybe this is like a paradigm shift. Of course, we don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe somehow our world is holographic in some weird way. And that would be the new paradigm. That would be the new thing that comes up. The new way, like Einstein came along, and then for 100 years afterwards, people thought completely differently about the universe. Maybe the holographic idea will have the same kind of effect. If it turns out to be true, or evidence for it builds up, then maybe we will be thinking completely differently about the nature of the universe. That's what's really cool about it. Potential for a real paradigm shift. And actually, maybe we can just take one more question, because we're at quarter after, and I think we need to wrap it up.
I was about to call on her.
Okay. Yeah, well, you kind of answered my question there. I was just about to say, like, if the world is a hologram, what can we do with that? Like, you said you can convert
read the information back and forth kind of thing? I don't know.
That is right. Ultimately, that's the question, isn't it? Right. Maybe I come up with this crazy sideways way of looking at things that opens up a new perspective, but what does that buy me? Do I really learn something about the way the world works? So from the point of view of trying to get after understanding what really happens with quantum mechanics and gravity, it's potentially a really important idea. You potentially learn a lot, because like I was saying a few minutes ago, if you don't know where to start on a problem, you have a hard time making progress. And one of the ways you try to start is you say, okay, what's really the fundamental principle going on? What's the fundamental principle I should be paying attention to when I try to reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics? And some people think that this is it, or part of it. So, assuming like this is true, then it buys you a starting point on this phenomenally hard problem that people have been working on for something like 75 years now. Now, if the question is, do I buy this holographic principle, what does it do for me when I go home this afternoon? Well, using the example we used a few minutes ago, if you're one of the scientists working on this experiment in Long Island at the relativistic heavy ion collider, like Sean was saying, maybe it buys you some new insight to understand all the measurements you get out of your machine. But like any scientific discovery, like any kind of new idea that tries to kind of leverage a place for us to make some more progress, you're never really sure what's going to come out of it. People pursue this because they think that it has certain applications, maybe helping you figure out how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, maybe building better models for what happens in colliders. But ultimately, right, it represents someone taking a guess at what happens in a situation, a circumstance that, before no one had ever really been able to imagine what was going on. So ultimately you don't know what's going to come out of it. Anything can come out of it, right? Ideas like this could trigger, one of you guys might go on to do physics and might think back to this and think about what you've learned since and have some, brand new realization that changes the way people think about things. Kind of the one thing we've consistently learned every time there's been the kind of paradigm shift that Richard mentions is that afterwards everything changes. And always in ways that you never would have guessed or expected, it ends up leading you to, invent new areas of science or solve old problems that used to seem insurmountable or develop new technologies or what does it do for you? Ultimately, it's a hard question to answer, right? You might say that one of the reasons we all worked on this is that we all want to know what it's going to do for us.
Okay, well, I think that's a great point on which to wrap things up. I think we have at the end of our time here. So I want to thank you guys for the questions. It's really been a lot of fun for Bob and I and for Sean to try to answer some of your questions. So let me just say a couple of things just in wrapping up here. So first of all, there are a lot of really, really exciting mysteries that are currently being explored. Okay, so never let yourself be fooled into thinking that somehow, Newton and Maxwell and Einstein and all these great people have answered all the questions.
Okay, that's very far from the truth. In fact, the reverse is true. Every time we resolve a mystery, we open up a yet deeper mystery. So there's a lot of exciting research out there, for you guys to think about, for the next generation to think about. Okay, so that's certainly true. And of course, I just want to say, please join us for the next Black Hole Science Cafe. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, which has public lectures on this topic and a whole bunch of other really, really exciting topics and many, many more resources. So thanks a lot for coming out, and goodbye.